2 years ago, my wife and I went on a roots journey to Europe. I never wanted to go to Lithuania or Poland. I didn't want to set foot on those cursed lands. But she sort of talked me into it, and I never regretted it. It was something where I learned so much, and it was certainly a worthwhile experience. And here just the shiur will be built around a few vignettes of what I saw there. Number one is, I think, very fascinating. Our first stop in Europe was in Vilna. Vilna. And when we got off at the Vilna airport, we were all given little flags. And the little flags had a note attached to it. And I read the note. I read the note. There's the note. Let's read it. We wish to congratulate all Lithuanians and country's guests on Lithuanian National Day. On the 6th of July, 1253, the coronation of Mindaugas, Lithuania's first and only king, took place. The coronation of King Mindaugas and his wife, Duchess Morta, is one of the most significant events in Lithuanian history. The papal bull issued on this occasion established Lithuania's placement under the jurisdiction of the Bishop of Rome, which meant recognition of the state of Lithuania. Since the 6th of July, 1991, this date is celebrated as Lithuanian National Day. I don't know why I only thought of it this morning, but you know what? It's something that had occurred to me a long time ago, but this morning I'm playing around with the computer and I typed in National Independence Days. And there it is. Wikipedia gives you the list of every country in the world with its National Independence Day. Of all things, the largest amount that's written, most of them are one line, a half a line, about this thing called Yom Ha'atzma'ut. Well, and it's been occurring to me for a long time now, there is not a single country on the face of this earth that has an Independence Day that is more powerful, more majestic, more significant, more moving than the Yom Ha'atzma'ut of Medinat Yisrael. There isn't a single other country in the world where their National Independence Day is the end of a 2,000 exile from the land. There is no other country on the face of this earth that has an Independence Day that opens up the gates to hundreds of thousands of Jews who are still in DP, former concentration camps in Europe. There is no other Independence Day on the face of this earth where millions of Jews from throughout the world came back, or millions of Lithuanians, or millions of Estonians, or Swedes. There's nothing like it. It's the most moving and most powerful Independence Day of all. It also happens to be an Independence Day that was already predicted by the Nevi'im. We're not going to go into that now. So I get a little hot on the cow, a little on nerve when I bump into people who trivialize it. It is an ingratitude to God's outpouring of kindness to his people. I respect the Lithuanians. If they can make a tzimis and a tararari, understand, because in 1253, is that when it was?
Yeah.
King Ming Daoist, do we don't know a thing about him? And his Duchess Morta, one of the most significant events in Lithuanian history. The adjustment Chaim of Lithuania. Mandel Hashina of Lithuania. I am first, I'm ready to sing the Lithuanian anthem if I would know. Well, I'm not so excited about Lithuania. You know what? As long as they had a significant Jewish community, they were a significant country. When they lost that Jewish component to Lithuania, they became very, very insignificant. That's the way it is. A Vilna that was world famous is nothing. It's all nothing. But I respect a country that has significant events in their history, and they celebrate it. They venerate the day. Kal v'chomer, the Yom Ha'atzmaut of Klal Yisrael. Wow. This is God's great gift to his people. And I look forward to saying Hallel with a bracha, regardless of what other members of the community that I'm part of may believe. That's number one. So that's arrival. This is the airport in Vienna. We spent our first Shabbos there. And Friday night I was asked to say a Dvar Torah. And the following is the Dvar Torah that I said Friday night in Lithuania. And it will also be of significance throughout this year. The Gemara in Masechta Sanhedrin says the following. Omer Rav Yochanan, Mipnei ma zocha oto rasha likroto asnapar rabba viakira. There was a Rosha by the name of Sanhedrin, king of Ashur. Sanhedrin, the king of Ashur, is the one who decimated 80% of Eretz Yisrael, sent the 10 tribes into exile, and he is destroyed as he surrounds Yerushalayim and wants to take the city of Yerushalayim. The great story in Tanakh of the angel of death who swoops down upon the camp of the Assyrians, and 180,000 die in one night. There ends the great siege of Yerushalayim. A miracle. The Chen Vayi Bachatzi Halayla. We mentioned it in the Haggadah. Middle of the night. Finished. Sanhedrin and a few of his people survive and flee back to Assyria. The great, mighty conqueror. Nasha. Sanhedrin. But the Gemara says, Rav Yochanan asks, in the book of Ezra, he's given a title, Asnapar, the great and venerated Asnapar. Whatever Asnapar means, it's some kind of a great title. So Rav Yochanan asks, this Rasha, why is he called that? The Gemara says, Rav Yochanan's answer is fascinating. Mipnei shalom dibek siper begenuta shel Eretz Yisrael. Because he did not speak derogatorily about Eretz Yisrael. What does it mean he didn't speak derogatorily? Because when he came and conquered the northern kingdom and he prepared to take the 10 tribes into exile, he told them, I'm going to take you to a land like your land. He didn't tell them that I'm taking you to a far, far better place. He didn't tell them that they're being resettled in the east, in what kind of amazing places. He said to them simply, I'm taking you a land like your land. Shenema, abo v'lokachti etchem el eretz ka'artzachem. Avon Yisrael. This is the difficult part of the Gemara. Avon Yisrael Siplu Benintam Shel Eretz Yisrael. Jews did speak derogatorily about Eretz Yisrael. Rabbi Yochanan is making such an indictment. What an indictment to the Jewish people. And what is it that Rabbi Yochanan says? He goes on to say, Kimotu Shosh. When they came to a place, Shosh, they said, Amri, they said, Shavya Kiyanin. This is just like our land. This is just like Eretz Yisrael. Ah, and then Kimotu Amin. This is very important. When they came to a place called Amen, they said, Amru, they said, Ke Amen. This is just like Amen. Rashi says, Amen means Yerushalayim. Because in Yerushalayim, the Beit Olamim, the eternal house of God, was there. When they came to this Farshlugana place, someplace out on the edge there, they said, my, this is Yerushalayim. Now, when I learned this Gemara, I said, I therefore believe that calling Lithuania or Vilna, calling Vilna Yerushalayim of Lita, could never have come from a Jewish source. I think that the Gemara is saying very clearly, you're not allowed to call any place Yerushalayim. I used to be upset. Where was it? In Queens. There were pizza places, Jerusalem 1 and Jerusalem 2. I remember when Jerusalem 2 burned down, I said this was Churban Bayit Shlishi. You understand? Fadl Chagdan, you're going to go call pizza parlors Jerusalem of Christ. Everything is Jerusalem. You're not allowed to. You're not allowed to. Because that's speaking Begidutah Shel Eretz Yisrael. That's speaking ill of Eretz Yisrael. There's only one Yerushalayim. There is no other Yerushalayim. And I've heard it already. Let me say the following. One of the greater moments in my life was when I was visiting a certain community in the United States, and the rabbi introduced me to my big congregation. I get this great cover that he says, we'd like to welcome Rabbi Shalom Gold, who is here from Yerushalayim to Eretz Yisrael, of Eretz Yisrael, visiting our great community, Yerushalayim of America. Now, I tell you, if there would have been a hole someplace for me to creep into, and you know, my neshama said, get up there and scream. And you know what? I didn't. I just felt the bezoyon of Yerushalayim, and I remained silent. And I remained silent, not because I wanted to my covet. I just quote Hatav, quote a rabbi in his congregation. You have to be very careful, never to in any way impinge on his covet. Vayidom Shalom. Right? But wait, that's not the end of the story. A few weeks after I had said this shir, I had said this in a shir in Harnov, one of the members of my shul, Olav Shalom, Hyman Flax, he was a fellow from St. Louis, had been for many years the executive director of the Vata Kashrus of the Vata Ir of St. Louis, comes walking into shir, and he says, Rabbi, you're right. When Napoleon entered Vilna in 1812 and he was taken through the ghetto of Vilna, he said, my, this is just like Jerusalem. It was Napoleon who called Vilna the Yerushalayim of Lithuania. Did not come from a Jewish source. Believe me, it wasn't the Vilna Gaon or any of his Talmidim. This is going to be significant as we go on. in the Shia. Number three is just an aside. I can't help but I have to say number three because I have to say number three. At least thank God the name of the rabbi doesn't appear over there. But Shul with a View is a page that appears in every week's edition of Mishpacha magazine in English. No, it's a different rabbi every other week, but it appears every week.
Oh, okay.
It appears every week, but it's not the same rabbi each week, and you can't see who it is. So now, let's read number three. Right? The rabbi here is talking, this is a rabbi who's talking about all the preparations they have to make for Pesach, all the doshes that he has to say, the shailos that he has to answer. Time for countless drushes and selling comments, answering questions and dealing with stress. Almost every free moment I can steal away from the phone is spent cloistered in my office, poring over svarim and doing my best to be original, creative, and witty, while simultaneously informative. Now, I particularly struggle with how to strengthen our belief in Lashono Habo B'Yerushalayim next year in Jerusalem. I don't know what his problem is. As the long, bitter gullus continues unabated, did it disappear 3 weeks ago, I believe? As the long, bitter gullus continues unabated, nothing has happened, by the way, in the last 65 years, you want to say. Not a thing has happened in Jewish history. As the long, bitter gullus continues unabated, while Jews declare every year with complete belief that next year they will be in Yerushalayim, I wonder how I can give hope and encouragement. I'm getting all broken up over here. How I can give hope and encouragement and foster continued belief that any moment a new and improved reality can be at hand. Who's crazy? Am I crazy? Was he crazy? Is he off the wall? Nothing's happened. You understand? There's no new reality. You understand? It's all the same. What it was 70 years ago, that's what it is today. There are concentration camps. There are Jews in exile. There are 400,000 Jews living in Eretz Yisrael. He doesn't know that this is the largest Jewish community in the world. He doesn't realize that the last time Eretz Yisrael had the largest Jewish community in the world was, you know when? In the days of Yahushua, during the period of Bayit Sheni, the second temple, the maximum number of Jews living here was 2,350,000, while there were another 7 million in Asia Minor, most of them living in Babylon. 65 years ago, or 70 years ago, there must have been 30 countries in the world that have larger Jewish populations. Today, largest Jewish population in the world, and it will soon be the majority of Jews. And the long bitter illness continues unabated. You understand? You know what's guaranteed to get you crying like babies? And I did it to myself again last night. I love punishing myself. To watch the just a few minute film of Israeli planes flying over Auschwitz. Just go on Google Israeli Air Force or Air Force over Auschwitz. Nothing happened, you know. The bitter ghost continues unabated. Nothing has changed. Everything's the same. Is he mad? I constantly look for sources indicating how the gula can occur in the most unlikely and unexpected ways. He doesn't realize that we're in the process of gula. Gula is not going to happen in one single instant of time. There's a process. The process started 100 years ago when Jews started coming back and planting and plowing the land, and many died in the process of doing that. And little by little, the country began to give out produce. It hadn't produced anything for 1900 years. Then my wife goes off to all these shiurim, you understand. She's learning all over the place. She comes home and she had a shiur that has to do with the halachas hakluyos b'oreis, shmita, the yovel. In the world, number one in the world in agriculture, number one, it's not Lithuania, number one in the world in agriculture is this country, Medinat Yisrael. About 80% of what's produced here goes out to for export. The most modern methods in the world are right here. Nothing changed. The long goes, continues, unabated. This is not the Rabbeinu Shel Olam. This is not the bracha of the prophets. What's going on over here? An army that's most probably second or third in the world. This is unbelievable. This is a God pouring out his kindness to the Jewish people. So I wrote a letter to the editor. But I knew that this letter to the editor, they'd never publish. Unless, I don't know, I'm going to buy the magazine this week. I think it's out today. I don't think there's a chance. The only thing that I accomplished by writing the letter is emotionally and psychologically, it did me good. I told him, listen, your problem is, dear Rabbi, you don't have a shul with a view. I asked the editor to invite him to come visit my shul in Har Nauf, the mountain of a view, and in my shul, I'll take him to the window and he'll be there looking at a shul with a view. And he'll look out the window and he'll see an amazing panorama of Yerushalayim being built before his very eyes. Then I further got said, it could be those two things over there, he can't see through the stained glass windows of his shul with a view, and maybe they're a little dirty. He doesn't see what's going on. The gullus continues unabated. When you have spiritual leaders that think and write this way, and magazines that publish this kind of stuff. Oh, yeah. Yeah, you know, I told this to. I met my good friend, the Kiddush, on my block, this Shabbos, Jonathan Rosenblum. Jonathan Rosenblum, yes. We love each other. He's really a wonderful fellow. Really wonderful fellow. But if you still have the Jerusalem Post of this past Friday, you'll see all the letters to the editor are attacks on Jonathan Rosenblum, and Jane Shapiro has one. My wife said Jane's was the best letter. I can't tell you that. It doesn't take me another hour to explain what's going on over there. Anyway, so I told Jonathan Rosenblum, how do you have this kind of stuff published in a magazine? The gullus continues unabated. Nothing has happened. Wow. Okay, let's go further.
How did he answer you?
Now, we don't answer each other. We just attack each other. That's all. Number five. Did we do... Oh, wait a minute. Wait, no, no, no. Number four, I just wrote the word Lublin. We visited Lublin. Lublin, there's really only one thing to see. And that's the great yeshiva that was built by Rav Meir Shapiro, the one who originated the Tafiyami. There was a Knessia Gedola, one of the great gatherings of our Buddhist school in Vienna in the summer of 1923. And there were two decisions that were taken there. One was a decision to establish the Tafiyami, which has caught on now more than ever before. Unbelievable amount of Torah that he studied. And Rabbi Meir Shapiro at the time was one of the youngest members who were there. He was probably no more than, well, I don't know, he had to be in his early 30s. Yeah, that was 23. I don't know exactly. The Knessia Gedola was in 23. Rabbi Meir Shapiro died young. In 33, he died at age 46. So he was 36 years old. So one decision was the Tafiyami. The other decision was to establish a central great yeshiva in Lublin, and it was called Chachmi Lublin. It was a major undertaking. You see the building, it's a tremendous, tremendous structure. The groundbreaking or cornerstone laying was sometime around 1925. 50,000 people were there, and then it was completed in 1930. And of course, it was a profound tragedy. In 1939, the Germans came into Lublin. They gutted the entire building, and they took the 20,000 svarim in the library and burned it in the streets of Lublin. And historical reports say that the cries of the Jewish community were so terrifying to the Germans that they brought in their orchestras to play loud music so they wouldn't have to hear the cries of Jews who saw 20,000 svarim, the great library of Europe, being burned. Just remember. Nothing has changed. The long bitter gullus continues unabated. But there are two things that are not known about Lublin. One, and I checked this out. I heard it from somebody, then I checked it with somebody who runs a Zichronen Memorial Center for the Shoah in Bnei Brak, that Rav Meir Shapiro, before he died, said that he never regretted any decision he ever made in his whole life except one. The decision to build the yeshiva in Lublin. He should have built it in Yerushalayim. That's an honest man. And the second, 1923, the Knessia Gedola in Vienna, Rav Avrom Yitzchok HaKohen Cook was then a member of Aguda, but he was in Eretz Yisrael at the time, and things were happening here. He could not leave in order to attend the Knessia Gedola, but he sent a letter. And in his letter, he asked that they propose the construction of a central yeshiva in Yerushalayim for anybody in Poland who, in Europe, wants to come learn. There should be a yeshiva in Yerushalayim. They never even bothered reading the letter. And of course, Rav Cook, of course, is the one who, as some Rashiva in this city said in a shir, he couldn't see further than his nose. Rav Cook saw light years away. He was ahead of his time. That's Lublin. Page 5. Number 5. You know, I don't know if I'm going to read the whole thing. This piece comes from the Ema Balansmecha. Maybe we'll read a few lines. And it became very important to us because it Well, it always troubled me. Basically, what he says is the following. There was a great Jewish community in Worms, in Germany. In Hebrew and Yiddish, it was called Vermeise. Vermeise is one of the places where Rashi learned for about 5-6 years. There's a Rashi shul there. There's a Rashi bridge. I remember coming into the shul and looking at the seat where Rashi sat. God, I was overwhelmed. So that was one of the places that we were going to visit, was Worms. So we had a little incident of our own on the way to Worms. We were in a... And that was not on the Roots trip. This was last summer. The Roots trip was 2 summers ago. I mean, you have to have our whole itinerary clear. You know, I don't want you to get confused with anything. Anyway, so last summer, we went to some place for a week in the south of France, and they take you on day trips, and here's the day trip, we're going to Worms. I didn't go on most of the day trips. I wanted to relax, take it easy. I don't come for a week to Europe to go running around all over. What's the dude saying? What's there to see it in Europe anyway that I'm interested in? But Worms, Vermeise, wow, I gotta see that. Okay? So, tour bus leaves the hotel, France. We're on the way to Vermeise. We stop at a rest stop, and at the rest stop, the guide tells us, leave everything on the bus. We're just going to go for a few minutes. Rest stop, back to the bus. Okay, so, this way is. Bela and myself, we come out, and we're looking for the bus. Wait. There are a lot of buses there. Running from one to the next. Oh, the bus isn't there. The unthinkable had happened. 2 Jews were left behind. I thought no Jew would be left behind. The 2 of us are left behind. We don't have our cell phones because we're told to leave everything on the bus. We don't have our food. We don't have anything. We don't speak the language. We don't have the phone number of the bus, or the hotel, or the guide. So here it is. We go looking for an office. We talk to this one. We try to talk to that one. I don't have to tell you, but by about 20-25 minutes into this odyssey, we're reaching the point of being frantic and full of panic. But then, as my great hero Richard Nixon always used to say, when the going gets tough, the tough get going. So Baylor tells me, let's find somebody who speaks English. So I see a youngish fellow, early 30s, most probably maybe middle 30s. We consider that young. We consider that very young. He's getting into his car. I walk over to him and I ask him, do you speak English? He says, yeah, there was a slight German accent over there. Yeah, he speaks English. Great. I tell him my story. They left us behind. We don't know what to do. We don't know where to go. So he says he's on his way to Mainz, but he can go through Worms on the way to Mainz. And then he says, you know what? I think today I'm going to Worms. Get in. We get into the car, and as we get into the car, Baylor whispers to me, don't tell him where we are from. She meant well. She meant well. You know, Europe is not a very friendly place these days. Not at all. There's a resurgence of anti-Semitism here. Anyway, we start driving, and sure enough, about 10 minutes into the ride, he asks, where you're from? And I answer instantly, Jerusalem. She faints. Jerusalem. Okay? Not me, I'm sorry. Yes, we are from, that's where I'm from.
Yeah.
I have my card. A Yerushalmi? Do you have a Yerushalmi card?
They're giving
him Matzah. They're giving him Matzah. I have a Yerushalmi card. What are you talking about? I wouldn't go anyplace. I wouldn't leave home without it. A Yerushalmi. Anyway, about 3/4 of an hour, an hour later, we make it into verse. So I tell him, he's Derek Kuhn, and he's sitting with his female companion, Dominique. And so I tell him, let us off in the center of town and we'll make our way. He doesn't even respond to me. But the two of them have all these handheld things of the 21st century. An iPhone, an earphone, a handheld computer, a GPS, and the two of them already, they haven't said a word to each other, but the two already have on their computer all the places of Jewish interest in Worms. So he says, take a guess. Where are they? Where do you think they went to? So I said immediately, the old Jewish cemetery. So they get the exact into the GPS, car turns around, they start driving through Worms, and then all of a sudden we turn a corner and Bela says, there's our bus right in front of the old Jewish cemetery.
Yeah.
It was very clear that Derek, most probably Huzeda may have been an SS stormtrooper, was doing tshuva. His little tshuva, he's not going to leave the two of us any place unless he brings us back to home. That same word was clear, was understood. Anyway, we get out of the car, we thank them profusely, Derek and Dominique go off, and meanwhile, the bus driver is standing there with a rabbi from Mainz who's getting ready to go out across Germany to find us. So now we had a number of ways of approaching this. I think some people would have come out of the car and said, wait, what did you do? You left us behind. The worst sin that you can do, two old people. We played it a little different, you know. You know the way we played it? We played it like the Golds. You put us any place. We'll make our way. Don't worry about us. Anyway, you have no idea. Everybody was so happy to see us. They were finishing their tour of the cemetery. And then all the women get around Bela and arrive there. They were so worried. I'm sure everybody, Jews love guilt. They must have all felt guilty. Why didn't I notice they weren't there? How could we not notice that they weren't there? How didn't we read the whole list? And then the men took me through the cemetery. It's an unbelievable, it's the only cemetery that was not destroyed during the Second World War. Its natural beauty is unbelievable. Shade trees, grass, and this, the Maharami Rutenberg is buried there. And next to him is the fellow who ransomed his body for a massive sum of money 14 years after he had died. Because the Maharami Rutenberg refused to be ransomed because the price was too exorbitant. So we went there, and then we went to the Maharil. The Maharil most probably is the underpinning of all of Ashkenazi halacha. All right. Okay. Now comes what the Emma Bonesmecha says. I'll tell it to you without reading it now. He talks about the fact that the community of Worms, Wermeiser, suffered more than most Jewish communities in Europe throughout history. During the Crusades, nearly the whole city was slaughtered. in the 14th century during the Black Plague, Jewish community was wiped out again. It rebuilt after each time, but there were many pogroms that happened there. And then on Kristallnacht, that was it. And he brings from a sefer called Seder HaDoros that was written about 400 years ago, that there is a Masorah, a tradition that says the following. The Masorah says that when Ezra came back after the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, he comes back from Bethel, they sent out letters of invitation to Jewish communities in the world, inviting them to come back and join them. And it even, the invitation simply said, you know, if you're going to be living here, wherever you live, you'll be able to come for the Shul of Shul Golem, you'll be able to come, pay some shuas and sukkahs to the Beit HaMikdash, come back. It would seem to me that most communities took Ezra's letter and just dumped it in the waste paper basket. But the Jews of Vermeise, according to tradition, sent back the following reply. Their reply to Ezra was, Atem shvu b'Yerushalayim ha-gedola, v'anachnu neshev b'Yerushalayim ha-ketana. You continue to live in the great Yerushalayim. We will live in the little Yerushalayim. Right, you see how everything is beginning to fall into place? You can't call any other place Yerushalayim. And to say that you're not coming back because you're living in Yerushalayim, Hakatana brought death and destruction upon that city. My postscript, of course, is maybe the very fact that when he asked me where we're from, I said Jerusalem was a kapara for the head of Hermeza. Didn't make the same mistake. I come from Yerushalayim, and I'm proud that I come from Yerushalayim. The Eim Abonim Smecha continues, of course. We don't have time now to talk about the Eim Abonim Smecha. We've talked about it often in the past, or not so often. I'm sorry, it's about time to go through it again. It says that, therefore, from Germany, all the worst sorts of Klal Yisrael emerge from that country. And that's a Masorah. I didn't make it up. Yerushalayim, Yerushalayim HaKetana. And now, it's gone. For me, just a fascinating aside was that two blocks from Rashi's shul is the Rhine. There are a number of places in Shas where Rashi describes rafts that traveled across the Rhine bringing goods from one place to the next. And here it is. Rashi most probably took a walk at night. He walked over to the Rhine. Number six. And whatever we don't finish now, you know, we always have... Number six, it has an extremely important message of all that. It's the Haftorah for this Shabbos. This coming Shabbos is going to be Parashas Tazria Mitzorah. And when Tazria and Mitzorah are together, the Haftorah is the Haftorah of Parashas Mitzorah. There's an awesome story in this Haftorah. The city of Shomron, which was the capital of the ten tribes, is surrounded by the king of Aram, the superpower of the day. In the city, hunger, absolute hunger. And the description of how intense the hunger was, so difficult even to describe it, but there it is described in Tanakh. And after it begins that there were four people, lepers, who were outside of the city, because lepers were not permitted into walled cities. They're out there. And they're also dying of hunger. And around the city is the massive camp of the forces of Aram. It's at night. They're going to die. So they say, listen, we have nothing to lose. Let's go throw ourselves upon the camp of Aram. They'll kill us. Otherwise we'll die from hunger. Maybe they'll give us a little bit, a stickle bread. They'll give us a little bit of bread. They come to the camp of Aram, go into one tent. Nobody there. They start going from one tent to the... Nobody's there. No. Hundreds of thousands of soldiers, they're gone. And the camp has food supplies. And then they decide, you know, today is good news for the Jewish people. We dare not remain silent. We have to go to the city and scream up to the top and say, they're gone. They're all. The siege has been lifted. Which they do. King doesn't believe it, you understand? King is a Kaiser Kuchen. Like we're all, everybody's a Kaiser Kuchen. He figures out this is a trick. Aram is really hiding in the hills. They're waiting for us. They know we're so desperately hungry. We're going to come out and they're going to come down and pounce out of the soil. Anyway, one of the people there says, let's send out, we have a few horses left. Let's send out horsemen to find out what the story is. They send out horsemen. And you know, the horsemen come back and say, it's true. They're gone. Miraculously, God had made the Arameans hear terrible noises of a mighty army coming against them, and they fled. You know, God can do it. You know, a siege doesn't have to continue unabated. They ran. Before the Haftorah, the story is told that Elisha the prophet had said, tomorrow they're going to be selling in the gates of Shomron grain at rock bottom prices. This is a city that is starving to death. And the king's captain says, is God going to make windows in heaven and pour down food to us? He mocked the words of Elisha. And Elisha told him, you know what? It's going to be that way. You're going to see it. And you're not going to eat from it. The section that I have over here is the end of that time. And then the Haftorah says the following. They took two chariots with horses. The king sent them out after the camp of Aram. Go and see what happened to them. They went. They went all the way to the Yarden to check. The whole road is full of clothing and all sorts of things that the Arameans had cast onto the road so that they should be able to run quicker. They're all gone. The messengers came back and they told the king. The people went out for Yavozu et Machane Aram. They took the spoils of the camp of Aram. Vayehi, and you know what? Exactly as that Elisha had said, a saw of solace was sold for a shekel, and two saw of barley, the shekel, Kidvar Hashem, as was the word of God. And who did the king appoint to be in charge of the distribution and sale of the food? Vamelech hifkid et hashalish. The aide upon whom he leaned, he had put him in charge. And you know what happened? The people trampled him bashar at the gate by Yomos, and he died. Kasher diber ishulkin, exactly as the man of God had said. Asher diber beredes hamelech elav, as he said when the king came down to him. Vayehi, and now the Navi repeats exactly what was said all the way at the beginning. Vayehi, Kedaber Ishulakim, as the man of God, Elisha, had said to the king Lamar, Sasayim Saurim Beshekel, Tug Saw, big measure of barley for a shekel, and Saw Solos Beshekel, Yerkeis Macha, tomorrow at this time, Beshar Shomron, in the gate of Shomron. And you know what had happened there by Yan HaSholish at Ishulakim? And the captain had answered the man of God, and he said, V'hinei Hashem Osad Ubot Hashanayim, God is going to make windows in the heaven. Hayyeh Kadavar Azeh. Can anything of this sort be? Hayomer, and the Navi told him, Hidlchor Ro'eh Be'enecho, you're going to see it with your own eyes. Shem Lo Tochen, but you're not going to eat from there. And that's exactly what happened to him. The people trampled him in the gate and he died. What's unusual over here, of course, is the fact, I believe, that it's the only haftarah, all the haftarahs that we ever say, that end with something. They trampled him and he died. A haftarah always ends with something good. With something nice. The haftarah of the end of Yeshayahu that we read on Shabbos Rosh Chodesh, the last pasuk in Yeshayahu is the pasuk of what will happen to the Rishoyim. We repeat the pasuk before or after. We don't end with something bad. And here we end with something bad. Question is, what was the sin of this Sholish? One could assume that he questions God's ability to feed the city. He questions the prophecy of the Elisha. So there's a medrash that's so fascinating. Ay, what a medrash! Medrash says, "Now he believed that God can do it." He is a man in Be'emunah Shleima. He believes in God. God can open up the very heavens and he can pour out. He believes the Navi Elisha. But the Medrash says he had used the word, the phrase, Arubot HaShamayim, the windows of the heaven. That's used one other place. In Tanakh, when God pours out the marble, when he pours out the Arubot HaShemayim opened and God rains down punishment and suffering. So the Medrash says, you know what this Sholish has said? He said, I'm sure the Rebbeinu can do it. Of course Elisha's right. But the Rebbeinu Shel Olam is going to make a nest for these Rishoyim? These people are idolaters. The Jews are bad. God doesn't do miracles for Jews that are bad. And then there are some who are worse than idolaters. There are some who are Zionists. There are ones who are even worse. They're Mizrachistim. God doesn't do miracles for these kind of people. You know what this Sholish is doing according to the Medrash? He has no understanding of God's care and concern for his people, though they be sinners. If they find themselves in dire straits, he's going to bring miracles from them. And not only that, who are the ones that bring the great message that there's food out there? Four lepers. Chazal say it was Gehazi and his three sons. Don't tell me any stories that the Kabbalah only brings miracles through shining Eden. You have to be a full-fledged Shem Shabbos, Al-Kotashis, that the Ben Shem loves the Jewish people. And the tragic mistake of this Sholosh, Shainet Chimayim, to understand, for these Geshul out there, the Ben Shem, These are marble people. That's what they are. Arubos HaShomayim. For that, he is disgracing the Jewish people who are God's people. For that reason, by Yirmisu Ha'om, by Yemos, the people trampled him to death and he died there. Ending the Haftorah this way is a very, very powerful message. The powerful message is the following. If the Shir began with the idea that you're not permitted to say anything derogatorily about Eretz Yisrael, you also can't speak evil of the Jewish people. And you know what the Haftorah may be telling us? Tzaras comes for Lashon Hara. So everybody thinks, I can't, it's not right, I shouldn't talk Lashon Hara about Chaim or Yankel or Sucha or Hifke, Leah. And during the 9 days we have big Chofetz Chaim heritage foundations gatherings, you understand? But about Jews? Read the papers, what's going on now in certain segments of our community. What kind of ugliness is being said about Klal Yisrael? Now we know what the Mizrahi is. Oikrei Torah, sign it out, destroy Yiddishkeit. Very, very, very bang. Our baby, you have to be very, very careful when you talk about Klal Yisrael. Talking about Klal Yisrael is just as bad as talking about Eretz Yisrael. And we learned already what happened to Kilos Vermeiza because they spoke against Eretz Yisrael. I'm going to take 3 more minutes. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I'm taking 3 more minutes.
That's okay.
Because I at least want to get to the end of the trip, which was very important. This was the end of our roots trip. I'm back to two years ago. Anyway, on our way back, it was supposed to be a flight, a Polish Airlines flight from Krakow to Vienna. And in Vienna, we were supposed to board an Austrian Airlines flight to Tel Aviv, coming up. Wait, okay? All right. To make a long story short, that trip home became a nightmare. We're in Krakow, and we're waiting for the flight, the Polish airline. Polish airline, okay. I'm going to leave out all the Polish jokes, you understand? Flight is supposed to take off, they're delayed. Whether he and her, the plane is delayed. When we finally get on the plane, we go to Vienna, it's pretty clear that chances are we're going to miss our connection to Eretz Yisrael. This is on Wednesday, okay? Wednesday. We finally arrive in Vienna. It's unbelievable. We get on to the Austrian Airlines flight, another Austrian Airlines flight to Eretz Yisrael. And we're taxiing, and all of a sudden there's some kind of a big explosion. We stop, and we don't know what's happening. Until finally we're told that they have to keep us waiting, I don't know, 20, 30 minutes. Pilot says that we were hit by lightning. So we're taxiing back, and we're going to bring in another plane. All right, they bring in another plane. It's already about 12:30 at night. We should have been in Eretz Yisrael already. And then we get into the other plane, we start taxiing, stop, Nachamul, half an hour, 2 hours, 1 hour, until they finally announce, you understand, a bird got caught in the engine. Okay? That's plane number 2. All right? And then, after another long wait, the pilot announces that this Austrian Airlines flight is hereby canceled. So they take us back to the lounge, and then back to the lounge. So of course we go over to the ticket counter. They want to send us to some hotel in Vienna, far short of the place. I stand there, you know, tough guy that I am, Nixon, you know? Huh? No, we need a place near the Jewish community so that we can have the kosher food available. All right, they send us to no less than the Vienna was only in the morning. In the morning when we came down, that we found out that the Vienna Hilton was the Vienna Saudi Arabia. It must have been, the whole place was Arab. But that's not the problem. There are nice things also. There are nice things also. The nice thing also was that one of the people who was on the flight is Fagi Hyman, whose husband had owned Ben Tzvi Travel. He got in touch with a fellow by the name of Berenholz, who runs a catering establishment in Vienna. At about 12:30 at night, he comes in with platters of food. Kiyad HaMelech. We were hungry after hours and hours of going nowhere. And there we spread out in the middle of the Vienna Hilton that we still don't know yet, because all of Saudi Arabia is sleeping then. And we're, all right. The next day passes. We have no flight back to. My days all mixed up, but that's fine. You're going to get the story anyway. Anyway, the following night, Thursday night, we end up all night. Thursday night was the night with the two bad flights, the lightning and the burr. So Thursday night, we come back to the lounge, and that's it. At 6 o'clock in the morning, the ticket counter will open, and we'll see what we can do. There are no more Austrian Airlines flights to Eretz Yisrael. We're going to try and get you onto other flights. In the morning, 6 o'clock in the morning, you didn't sleep much sitting with the Peck and the Zek and the Bebekus and all the stuff. It was a terrible, terrible night. Terrible night. Anyway, they don't have any way for us. They can't find any way. Here we are clamoring. We want to go home. We want to go to Eretz Yisrael for Shabbos. There were a bunch of Chassidish fellows who said that they found out that there's a flight from Vienna to Bucharest, and in Bucharest there's a connection that will get you to Eretz Yisrael for Shabbos. There's another group that had left for Warsaw, back to Warsaw. Yeah. The story is, there are a whole bunch of Jews who are desperately trying to get back to Eretz Yisrael for Shabbos. And we and a number of others are left in the airport, and we find out that there's an El Al flight. 12:30, there's an El Al flight to Eretz Yisrael. We go running to El Al. They don't know if there's any place. Here it is. Here it is. They don't know, they call patience, saflanut. We're sitting and waiting and waiting. And I have to describe to you the idea of not getting home for Shabbos after 48 hours of Valgen Zichreitle. 48 hours. We're hot, we're filthy, we're exhausted. Is geweckt, is gemutschend. Okay. A few minutes before the plane is supposed to leave, a woman comes over to me and very quietly hands me two boarding passes and says, "Board now." I couldn't believe it. I grab Bela and we board. We go through business class. We're someplace in the middle of economy class and I can't find the seat. So we turn around, we start going back, and stewardess sees I'm a little confused. So she takes the boarding pass and she points to business class. Elon came through again. They're not just taking us home for Shabbos. They're taking us home for Shabbos. Business class. I'll tell you, when we sat down, those two business class seats, I just want to tell you what went through our mind and what I felt like. And every time I think of it, I get all choked up again. There was a time when hundreds of thousands of Jews wanted to make their way to Eretz Yisrael. They walked across Europe. If only they could get onto an unseaworthy boat that was going to try and dodge His Majesty's Navy. Under the worst of conditions. Jews did anything to get to Eretz Israel. In such a minute way, I began to feel it. I wanted to get on for Shabbos. I was tired. I was exhausted. But you know what? We had a place to go home to. Not only we had a place to go home to, we had an LL that was there and was going to take us home. Hold Lashem Kitov. You understand? The long ghost continues unabated. Where in heaven's name is this guy living? Where is this guy living? I just sat there in that business class enjoying the fact that we're going home. And home is Yerushalayim. And we're going on a Jewish airline. And this is one of the thousands of reasons why Mirz Hashem next Tuesday I'm going to say hallel with a bracha with great kavanah. Chag Sameach.